This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. There's hyperbole about the critical importance of every general election, but this time the claim is most definitely warranted. The result may determine what our nation stands for generations. But modern methods of seeding lies and hysteria into a campaign, the precision of it, the craft, can be traced back to a single race in 1934 for California governor. Some years back, we talked to two lifelong students of history about how that race was run and what it wrought. We began with Greg Mitchell, who's written a dozen books about U.S. politics and history of the 20th and 21st centuries. He said that the governor's race was intensely watched because it was seen as a judgment on FDR's New Deal. Because, seemingly out of nowhere, the Democratic primary was won by Upton Sinclair, the prolific, muckraking author of The Jungle, which galvanized public outcry over the reckless disregard for public health and workers' lives in the meatpacking industry. An unabashed socialist, his political star rose when he launched a hugely popular anti-poverty campaign.
There's no excuse for poverty in a state as rich as California. We can produce so much food that we have to dump it into our bay.
I aimed at the public's heart, he wrote, and by accident, I hit it in the stomach. Mitchell told us that the reaction to Sinclair's primary win was swift and furious, ushering in the first modern media campaign. Mitchell described him as, among other things, a militant vegetarian, erstwhile socialist and scourge of the ruling class. Erstwhile, because after several unsuccessful runs as socialist, Sinclair changed his party affiliation to Democrat.
He led a mass movement called End Poverty in California, or EPIC, and managed to sweep the Democratic primary in a landslide with hundreds of thousands of votes and was the favorite to win in November.
So people knew who they were voting for.
Oh, absolutely. He was one of the most famous authors in the world. Today, we remember him mainly for The Jungle, but at the time, he was always in and out of the headlines, getting arrested, and was certainly a famous figure in California and around the country.
As you describe it, the swiftest response to his winning the primary came from newspaper magnates like William Randolph Hearst and the Chandlers,
right,
the family behind the Los Angeles Times, and also Hollywood.
Well, of course, the newspapers at that time were extremely reactionary throughout the state. They were owned by families. They had a lot of money at stake. And, you know, Sinclair, bless his heart, had been one of the leading media critics of his day. We think of Sinclair today as this muckraker, like an investigative journalist or something. He was mainly a novelist, and even The Jungle is a novel. So what the newspapers would do is they would take some outrageous thing that a character in one of Sinclair's novels said and would pretend that Sinclair had said it himself. So they would put it right on the front page and have him believing in free love and giving away money to everyone and hating the church. So yeah, the newspapers were in the forefront of the fight.
The Los Angeles Times also took shots at Sinclair's followers.
Yeah, they called him the maggot-like horror. Then it was so over the top.
the political editor of the Los Angeles Times, was a real kingmaker. His name was Kyle Palmer. And you cite this really amazing anecdote when he's having a conversation with the New York Times' star reporter, right, who was in California, a guy named Turner Catledge.
Turner came out there to cover the campaign in a fairly even-handed way, and was amazed there was no coverage about Sinclair at all in the LA Times, except for all the negative shots. And so he asked Kyle Palmer, how can you get away with only covering one campaign? And Palmer said, Turner, forget it. We don't go in for that kind of crap that you have back in New York of being obliged to print both sides. We're going to beat this son of a bitch, Sinclair, any way we can. We're going to kill him.
Quote, unquote. Okay, so what was Hollywood's beef with Upton Sinclair?
They thought that Sinclair and his former socialistic background was a threat to the movie industry itself. And so the first thing they did was they threatened to move to Florida. When that didn't work, they docked each of their employees one day's pay to be donated then to the GOP candidate. And then finally, Irving Thalberg at MGM made these newsreels that presented Sinclair and his supporters in the worst possible light and were actually mainly faked footage. Some of it was shot on the studio lot. They hired actors to portray bums and other Sinclair supporters.
This was the famous humanitarian, Irving Thalberg?
Yeah. He admitted it after the campaign that he was the one. And I managed to find these newsreels. They were sort of missing to history. They were really the first attack ads on the screen. And people back then got a lot of their news off the newsreels, and they thought they were the straight deal.
You say that this campaign marked the beginning of media politics. I want you to make that argument for me, because certainly negative advertising did not begin with the gubernatorial campaign of Upton Sinclair.
There, of course, had been dirty campaigns before this, but campaigns had always been run by political parties and their local leaders. But the Sinclair threat was so great, they turned the campaign over for the first time to what we now call political consultants, to PR people we now call spin doctors. This is the first turning over of the campaign to advertising people. The use of radio and the screen to make attack ads and national fundraising from all over the country in one state race. All of those things were unprecedented.
What was the substance of these smears that made it so unprecedented?
Sinclair said that if he was elected, California would become such a paradise that the unemployed would want to come to California. And of course, he was just joking about it. But they took that and they made radio dramas around it. They made two of these fake newsreels around it. They plastered it on billboards all over the state.
Horrific images of huddled masses,
right,
crowding into California.
Your inquiring cameraman interviewed 30 stated that they were on their way to California to spend the winter and to remain there permanently if the epic plan went into effect.
Hearst owned movie theaters, so he worked with MGM to get these newsreels into his movie theaters. He had all these people on every level of radio, newspapers, movies, advertising, all in the same room and saying, okay, how can we direct this campaign using all these different tools?
You're describing a sort of vertical integration of the political smear.
That's right, yeah. One of the things that was continually used against Sinclair was that he was a free love advocate, almost what you might call a hippie, bohemian, and so forth. This was because there were characters in his books who had these traits. He was a vegetarian, you know, which at that time was seen as somehow un-American. So he had some personal traits, but the odd thing was he was such a straight-laced, not in any way a free spirit that they pictured him as.
So were you convinced that it was the negative advertising that took down Upton Sinclair?
I think after coming off his primary win, which is at the very end of August, the Epic campaign was an incredible mass movement. I mean, they had 800 chapters around the state. They had a weekly newspaper that had 2 million circulation. I would say that if these new techniques and over-the-top, incredible, dirty tricks had not been employed, that Sinclair would have narrowly won.
Greg Mitchell is the author of, among many other books, The Campaign of the Century, Upton Sinclair's Race for Governor of California and the Birth of Media Politics.
Hollywood may have bankrolled and assembled the anti-Sinclair ads, but who helped to shape them, to coordinate them? Who honed the techniques of the out-of-context quotation and opposition research, now part of the standard campaign playbook?
Sinclair writes a book about what's been done to him, and he calls it the Lie Factory, but he doesn't even really know who's done it, who's behind it.
The masterminds behind that campaign were Clem Whitaker and Leone Baxter, the owners of Campaigns, Inc., the world's first political consulting firm.
They use invented organizations to print pamphlets all the time.
Jill Lepore, New Yorker staff writer, Harvard history professor, and author of just about everything you need to make sense of American history. We spoke to her about 8 years ago after she profiled the duo in The New Yorker.
Clem Whitaker had been a longtime newspaper reporter. He also founded a wire service, the California Feature Service. And Leone Baxter, who's this young widow, is hired to work with him on his first political campaign. They fall in love. He divorces his first wife and marries her. They work behind the scenes. No one really pays much attention to who they are. So it's very different from political consultants today who very much adore the limelight and are very much celebrities.
And yet, semi-anonymous as they were, they dominated this fledgling industry, winning 70 out of 75 campaigns. What was their secret sauce?
Well, the first thing they do is they hibernate for a weekend or some number of days when they're hired by any campaign, and they come up with a plan of campaign. They come up with all the rhetoric that they're going to use, exactly the way they're going to position their candidate. Then they write an opposition plan of campaign to imagine that there was someone actually opposing them, but there is no opposition. There are no other political consulting firms before the 1950s, so they're just really fighting their own shadow. They're boxing in the dark. But Whitaker says there's only two ways to interest Mr. or Mrs. America in a political campaign. You either have to put on a fight or you have to put on a show. It's no coincidence that political consulting comes out of California. It's very much bound up with Hollywood. Whitaker and Baxter had a rule. You know, if you have to explain something, you've already lost the issue. You never explain. Your obligation is to simplify the message and go on the attack. You can't win a defensive campaign.
One of their tricks was to come up with an allegation and just repeat it endlessly, no matter how, you know, dubious its merits.
Among their rules was this. You have to say something seven times to make a sale.
It also has echoes of Goebbels, the dynamics of the big lie. Were they on the same track?
You know, it's something that people in the 1930s were very concerned about with radio in general. There's a lot of concern in the 30s about propaganda in Europe. There's obviously a lot of concern about the border between fact and fiction in American radio broadcasting. I mean, just think about War of the Worlds and the controversy that that sparks. Baxter, in particular, later in life, looking back at the work she had done, thought about, was there a difference between what she was doing in Nazi propaganda? Not obviously at the level of content. She thought what she was doing was principled and that her political arguments were sincere. And I think they indeed were sincere. But I think she had come to understand, and this is reflected in this quite powerful oral history interview that's conducted with her later in her life. You know, it's like sort of believing in a benevolent dictatorship. You can't accept that these tools are a good thing if it depends on the nobility of the intentions of the people who hold them.
What's so spooky about your New Yorker piece is how much it seems to presage what goes on today. Tell me about the campaign against government-mandated health insurance.
Whitaker and Baxter were first hired in the state of California to defeat Earl Warren's proposed statewide health insurance program in the 40s. They had actually gotten Warren elected governor, but he had then fired them. He was pretty concerned about the methods that they used. He proposed a health insurance program. They were hired by, Whitaker and Baxter were hired by the California Medical Association to defeat it. They used all of their classical methods. They decided that what Warren was proposing was creeping socialism. They invoked the specter of Stalinism. They defeated it successfully by one vote. Warren was outraged. Harry Truman then picked up the cause. Both in California and nationwide, compulsory health insurance was incredibly popular. What Whitaker and Baxter did when they were hired then subsequently by the American Medical Association was take those same techniques that they'd used to defeat health insurance in California and bring them to the nation at large. And they did so very much with an eye toward defeating not only that proposal that Truman had offered, but health insurance forever afterward. They tell the AMA, you are hiring us not just to defeat this piece of legislation, you are hiring us to put an end forever to the idea that the federal government could have anything to do with health care.
This whole conversation, Jill, is premised on the idea that Campaigns, Inc. created in the 30s the template for all modern political campaigning. It's also completely protected by the thing we hold most dear, the First Amendment. Are we doomed to this kind of political cancer forever?
There was a great moment in the 50s when this political scientist named Stanley Kelly went around and interviewed a bunch of political consultants who were just starting out. He wrote this book about the founding of this industry. And he said, you know, what's going to happen? What's going to happen with this stuff? And one guy says to him, I give it a few months because really we're selling so much baloney. How much longer could anybody possibly believe a word we're telling them? You know.
Jill Lepore is the author of many books about American history, most recently, If Then, How the Simulmatics Corporation Invented the Future. Coming up, the whole press corps sitting with Linus in the pumpkin patch.
This is On the Media.